so much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Hey everybody, Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton. Every now and then we all need a shot in the arm, a little nudge to remind us that life is short and that we need to get up, get out, and live it while we have the chance. That attitude and this radio show are called Growing Bolder. And over the next hour, you're going to hear inspiring stories from people who got off the couch and made their lives something special. They're the kinds of stories that'll lead you to believe that, yeah, you can do it too.
Man, I can hardly wait, Bill. On today's program, you will hear from Dr. Sanjeev Chopra, who's going to tell us his five must-have ingredients to a long and healthy life. Also, we've got 60 Minutes correspondent Leslie Stahl. She'll check in with her unique take on what it's like to be a grandparent. We'll also hear from a professor at the University of Central Florida College of Medicine on how to minimize the possibility of mistakes in the hospital, and you'll find out why running might be the perfect activity for you. But we start with the guy who made the Tijuana Brass a household name. This is Growing Bolder.
Don't you love it? It's the timeless, timeless smooth sounds of Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass. And you know what, folks? A big part of growing bolder is being willing to take risks. It's hard to do, something that isn't easy. Most of us shy away from ever even trying. But do understand this. There is a huge difference between a reckless risk and a calculated one. Our next guest took a big risk. He started his own record company, A&M Records. Mark, how'd that risk work out?
Well, you know, understanding his talents, Bill, I'm not sure it really was a risk. But to answer your question, since then, he has earned 9 Grammys. He's recorded 29 gold and platinum albums, has sold over 72 million albums. He's a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, and to this day, the only artist ever to have a number one record as a singer and as an instrumentalist. He's wrapping up the Come Fly With Me tour at the Cafe Carlisle in New York with his Grammy Award-winning wife and three-piece band. Let's say hello to the one and only, the iconic Mr. Herb Albert. Hey, Herb, how are you?
Hey, I'm pretty good. I took a reckless risk.
Yeah, man.
I took a reckless risk singing, This Guy's in Love with You.
You know what? It's such a pleasure to talk to you. We've loved your music for decades. And what is touring like for you now with your wife, the incredible Lonnie Hall, compared to the days back then with the Tijuana Brass?
I'm having a really good time. My wife, you know, was the lead singer. She was the voice of Brazil 66. And we have a terrific relationship. We've been married for 42 years. And we have a good time singing and playing.
That surprises us, Herb, because everything we read, everything people tell you, is that after a certain age, boy, life is a slow spiral around the bowl and down you go. You're defying that.
Well, actually, you know, I'm having more fun playing. It's easier for me to play than it was 20 years ago. So I'm really exploring that. I love to make music. I started playing trumpet when I was 8. So it's just part of me. I do it every day. In fact, I was practicing right before I called you guys this morning. So I'm doing what I love to do. I think, you know, following your passion is the key to life. I wake up each morning, you know, thinking about things to do, like sculpting, painting, and blowing the horn.
Let's talk about the sculpting and the painting, because that's a side of you that, you know, I don't want to say not everybody knows, but, you know, maybe is overshadowed by your immense musical talent. Tell us about this other artistic side that you're involved in, because I know you've got a big show in Chicago.
Oh, I have 9 huge totems, bronze totems at the Field Museum in Chicago. And I've been doing it painting for over 45 years and sculpting for maybe 35. I just enjoy it. You know, I never thought anyone would be interested in what I was doing. I was just doing it for my own pleasure. And little by little, you know, people were interested and galleries wanted to explore my work. So I'm a lucky guy. I get to do what I feel is right for me to do.
And for, lucky for us, the things that you feel are right to do are of a huge benefit. I want to mention something else that you do that a lot of people don't, maybe don't think about all the time, but you do it with your wife. The two of you created something pretty magical. It's the Herb Albert Foundation. Every year for the last 20 or something, you hold the Albert Awards in the arts. And through that foundation, you've given over $100 million towards music education and artist development, and you're really digging deep to find some real talents that deserve to be nurtured.
Well, I just believe in the arts. I think the arts are an important ingredient to our society and the world, and there are a lot of great artists out there that don't really get a chance to be seen or heard. So for the last 21 years, we've had the Herb Albert Awards in the arts, and we award, X amount of dollars to five different disciplines. And it's been fabulous because we're looking for artists that are in mid-career. And I'm looking for the artists that are, exploring the road less traveled. I'm not looking for the cookie cooker cutter artists. I'm looking for the artists that have something uniquely special to say in their own special way. And that's it. Actually, the idea came from A&M when we started A&M in 1962 with my partner Jerry Moss. We were not looking for the beat of the week. We were looking for artists that had something uniquely special to say in their own way, like Cat Stevens and, Sting and Police and Quincy Jones and Janet Jackson and all the artists that we, Brazil 66, artists that just were, on their own little paths to make the type of music they felt like they had to make. And that's what I wanted to do for these creative artists that are exploring their own creativity. I think everyone is creative to a certain degree, and some people are just afraid to explore that, and they're too concerned with, is it good or bad? And I've had, some really pivotal experiences in my life. Walking out of the Sistine Chapel when we played with the Tijuana Brass in Rome, and I coming out of the other side of the Sistine Chapel, I was thinking like, wow, what? I can't paint, I can't sculpt, I can't. Michelangelo was on another planet, and then I started comparing myself to this creative genius, and that's like the wrong thing to do. I just got to get up to my own water level and leave it at that, and I've been able to do that, and that's how I feel about, making music. I wasn't comparing myself to Miles Davis or any of the great jazz musicians. I just wanted to, be myself and make that type of music that was naturally coming out.
And your music, Herb, is timeless, and you have a legacy that can never be challenged. But what we like about you is not just how incredible you were, but how amazing you continue to be. And as you're doing your thing, trying to make your industry better, Bill and I are doing our thing, trying to make sure people understand that there are those like you who just don't slow down, continue to be creative, continue to grow, continue to expand as they age. So are you okay with us mentioning your age, Herb?
Oh, absolutely, because, I'm 81, but I'll tell you the truth, I think 79 is the new 81. What do you think of that, man?
So here you are at 81, and man, you can hear the passion in your voice. You can hear your enthusiasm for life, the perfect example that age really doesn't matter, the kind of role model that the rest of us need, because, 20 or 30 years ago, there weren't a lot of guys like you out there in their 80s that were still getting it done.
Oh, tell me about it. I mean, when I was growing up and I'd see my uncles and aunts and uncles at 75, I was thinking like, man, they're ancient. But here I am, and I'm still cooking. I'm still really enthused about life. But, of course, I have a wonderful relationship with my wife, and that certainly plays a big part in one's happiness.
You do a million interviews, Herb, and I know every one of them, they all talk about your past and how did you do this and that, but what about your next adventures? At 81, what do you hope? What are you striving for the rest of your life to look like?
Well, actually, I don't know. I'm just doing, we're all striving to live in that moment, not think about the past, not think about the future, but think about what's happening now. As I was saying before, I was... I'm still practicing every day.
That's beautiful.
And Dizzy Gillespie was a dear friend of mine, and Dizzy used to say, "Man, the closer I get, the farther it looks. So that's the way it is being a musician. You know, you never get to that place where you just say, hey, that's it, I got it covered. You're always trying to inch up on it. It's a pebble at a time. And that's the beauty of the art world. You know, you never really arrive. You're just kind of striving. And there's, you know, like there's two types of artists, as I see it. There's the artists or musicians, let's say, musicians that are playing the right stuff. You know, they know exactly how they're going to play it. They're in tune, you know, they're with all the newfangled technical things that you can do nowadays. You can improve on a solo so quickly, and you can make it in tune. You can move pieces around, and those are the artists that are playing the right stuff. And then there's the artists that are looking for the right stuff, and that's the artists that are experimenting. You know, the ones that are just, you know, going a little left of center, and they're taking chances, and that's the artist I like to be. I like to, you know, take some chances, and I'm not really, believe it or not, I'm not concerned with what the public is going to think about the music I'm making. I'm more concerned with how I feel about the music I'm making, and I feel if it touches me, it's liable to touch some other people along the way.
And interesting too, Herb, people listen to that and they say, "Well, sure, he can be like that because he's Herb Alpert." But that you've not changed as far as that goes.
You know, that's an interesting subject that you just opened up because, you know, I was insecure. You know, when I started playing and was, you know, I was able to express myself. All of a sudden, I found myself trying to play like Louis Armstrong. I was trying to play like Harry James, a little bit of Miles Davis. And then I said, who in the heck wants to hear that? I mean, they've already done it. So I was looking for my own identity. And, of course, when I had the Lonely Bull in 1962, and I got all that feedback from people about, the music, it was in the top 10, and I got this letter from a lady in Germany, and said, "Dear Mr. Alpert, thank you for sending me on this vicarious trip to Tijuana." You know, and when I read that letter, I think, "Wow!" I chuckled. I thought, "Wow, isn't that interesting?" But then I thought that music was so visual to this lady that it transported her, and I kind of like said, "That's the type of music I want to make. I want to make music that takes you someplace when you hear it." Opposed to, you know, elevator music, which is okay, you know, it's there, but you don't go out of the elevator whistling anything.
and folks, at 81, he's still performing, still creating, still discovering, and who knows, the Herb Alpert Foundation may even be responsible for launching the next generation of incredible musicians. I think, Herb, though, if I may, you need a little bit more practice, so how about playing us out with something as we say goodbye to the incredible Herb? How about a little Lonely Bull?
How about that? The guy plays in tune as well.
Remember when running was just for athletes? Coming up, find out why now it might be the perfect activity for you. This is Growing Bolder.
Growing Bolder and Humana are celebrating the opportunity of aging and smashing stereotypes with the new 65 Plus. We're sharing examples of people 65 and older who are pursuing their passions and leading happy, healthy, and active lives. You can inspire others by sharing your own photos and stories. Find more information at growingbolder.com/new65plus.
You're listening to Growing Bolder Radio with Mark and Bill. Remember when running was only for athletes? Very few things in society have changed faster or more completely than the number of people in this country who've chosen to go out and run.
Yeah, great point. And whether it's in your neighborhood, at the gym, on a treadmill, a trail, or even around the block, if you've never done it before, sign up for the next 5K run. And don't worry about running. You can walk. You'll be amazed by the number of people there and the wide range of abilities. We saw it firsthand at the Zimmerman Kaiser Sutcliffe Winter Park Road Race and thought you'd like to experience it as well.
check out any run in America, any 5K, 10K, any marathon, or triathlon, and you'll see it. The ever-increasing number of people, 40, 50, 60, and older, people who've made the decision to run for their lives, to be there for their families, people taking ownership of their own health, fighting to increase their odds of a future filled with adventure.
This is the two-mile start.
Just ask John Hughes of Track Shack, who's been organizing runs for decades. This transition has been nothing short of transformational.
You know, Bill, I got to tell you, when I come to the events now and I see just the sheer numbers, but also everything has changed in the sense that the people that are out here, it's not just the guys that are running to get a prize or to run, you know, to win the race and run so hard. It's a whole spectrum, and that's just fantastic. I love seeing that.
And the change it makes in people over 40, over 50, who never in a million years would have expected themselves.
That's true. Like me now. But no, you're absolutely right. We do. We have a lot of people that say, yeah, I just started running in my 40s or my 50s or my 60s. We have Ann Call, who's in her, she's 80, running today. And it's just fantastic.
Ann is actually 86 and didn't start running until she was 50. And there are always a number of first-timers trying something they never expected to. A few years ago, how likely would you have thought it was if somebody came up to you and said, hey, I bet you're going to be it then?
It wouldn't have happened because a year and a half ago, I decided that I was going to start exercising and eating better, and I've lost 60 pounds.
Nervous?
Little.
But what's the benefit? I mean, why are you really here?
Oh, because it's going to make me feel better. When I exercise, I feel better. I have arthritis real bad, and the more I move, the better I feel.
I like walking, and Diane agreed to come with me because my greatest fear is parking, not walking. I've been walking for years. My husband had cardiac arrest. He died of heart disease because he wouldn't walk when he was supposed to.
It's just phenomenal. I feel so much better. I feel better about myself. My muscles feel better. And I can honestly say that I do not feel my age.
And there are those like Claudia Lane, who encourage others to give it a try.
Well, I'm a little bit of a mature adult exercise instructor. And it's lovely just watching people's quality of life get better by exercise. We don't have to take all those chemicals and medicine. And just by starting off just walking, it just really changes your life.
And she has proof right there by her side through the incredible experiences of Diane Faria.
I was blind and paralyzed, and then all of a sudden I was developed all this pain in the legs, and my doctor said if I could start walking, the pain would subside and I could get healthier. And so I'm going to challenge myself by walking.
And that's just from people starting out. Those who made good health their mission years ago are reaping unimaginable benefits. People like Angelo Cusimano, who we interviewed years ago.
The thing you guys don't understand, though, is that now you're old.
No, we're young. We're young. We're legendary. We're not old.
Well, you're right. I'm 52 years old with an 18-year-old son. But the bottom line is, there's nobody in the world, my age group, that can take me out on this course and beat me.
Well, that was then. Today it looks like very little has changed.
You're talking to the legendary old folks. You can't, man, you know how many people have found that on YouTube and have shown that to me? How long ago was that? 5, 6, 7 years ago?
Well, since then you've deteriorated severely.
Severe deterioration.
How old are you now?
I am 60 years old.
And you just broke 40 minutes
in a 10K? I kicked all these guys' rear ends, man. I just kicked all these guys' rear ends. Nobody came over the line that was over 50 years old in front of me. Nobody. And most of them didn't come over the line that were 20, 30 years old.
What does it say?
What it says is if you work on your body day by day, morning, evening, you watch your diet, you can retain a lot of the physical fitness that you want. The strength, flexibility, physical fitness. I mean, I got knee problems. I'm getting old, but the bottom line is it doesn't stop me from participating.
Yeah.
See, people get injured and they stop participating. you just got to participate at a lower level and find something that's suitable to you.
And not only that, people stop because nobody really loves the pain of running, but what...
Well, now that may be where the crazy guys elevate it, take it to a different level. My wife would tell you that I love the pain of running. When I get injured, I go out and run. I use the elliptical, the bike. I don't stop, so I never gain any weight. I'm the same weight as when I talked to you 5, 6, 7 years ago.
So what would you say is the bottom line? What do we need to tell people?
Well, the bottom line is everybody, you know, instead of trying to give people free medical insurance, we need to give them free exercise ideas. We need to, you know, incorporate in their mind that they have to get out and exercise. I mean, this is a beautiful place. Look how many people came out today to just enjoy the weather and, you know, not race, but just have a good time.
This has changed your life?
Oh, absolutely. Look at me. I'm 60 years old. I have a resting heart rate of about 55 beats a minute. My blood pressure is 100 over 60. I got about 5% body fat as a 60-year-old. And I can outrun almost everybody. There were 15, 20 people that in front of me, but that's not bad out of 4,000. And we'll be talking 10 years from now. It won't change. It's 70. You'll come back here, we'll talk again, and we'll be doing the same thing.
But you're not old.
No, I'm younger than that guy.
I was gonna say, we're not old.
No.
We're
legendary.
The always inspiring Angelo Cusumano. With all the proof you need, folks, half the battle is won just by signing up for a race. That way you'll be motivated to train a bit, and before you know it, you'll be just as proud of yourself as Angelo is of himself.
Need a little push? Go to growingboulder.com, search for Team Growing Boulder for training tips, testimonials, and more. Coming up, why going to the hospital can make you sicker instead of better, and what you can do to protect yourself. This is Growing Boulder.
Support for Growing Boulder provided by...
Savings accounts should build wealth, not add expenses. Raisin gives savers access to high-yield savings accounts, money market deposit accounts, and certificates of deposit from over 70 banks and credit unions. Find, fund, and manage multiple savings products all through a single secure login. More information at raisin.com/growingboulder.
You are listening to Growing Boulder. I'm Bill Schaefer. Have you ever had to stay in a hospital? Well, get this. Recent estimates are that one out of every three patients will experience a problem. Could be a drug mix-up, an infection, a surgical mistake, or even worse. Here's what you need to know. There are things you can do to minimize those chances. Our next guest is a board-certified surgeon with a clinical focus on minimally invasive surgery and surgical oncology. He's been awarded multiple teaching and clinical excellence awards and has been recognized as one of the best surgeons and best doctors in America. He is also the assistant dean for simulation and professor of surgery at the University of Central Florida College of Medicine. We are pleased to welcome Dr. Juan Sendan.
Thank you for having me on.
It's always so revealing and helpful to get to talk to somebody with your credentials, somebody who knows the medical field inside and out. And before we get into some things that patients can do to help self-guard themselves against, you know, the possibility of things going wrong, what does the medical community think about all this, and what steps are they taking from their side to cut down on some of the risk?
Well, the big item in the medical community has been simply the recognition that patient safety is so critical. It seems almost obvious to state it, but it wasn't really until 1999 or so the Institute of Medicine published a sort of eye-opening report that pointed to maybe as high as 100,000 unnecessary deaths from medical error occurring at that time, and that really shook everybody's confidence, the physicians as well as the patients. And in the interim, we've done a lot of hand-wringing and analysis trying to figure out what underlies that. So the medical community in the last 15 years has been really wrestling with that, trying to identify the different components and what parts we can repair as individual physicians, what parts are systemic, what parts the patient could potentially be involved in helping. So it's been really trying to get down to the granular level. What can all of these different folks do to make things better for the patient, to make it safer?
And Dr. Sindhun, I'm guessing that the solutions are being tracked all the way back to medical schools. What's happening there? How is teaching changing to maybe cut down on some of the risks?
Well, through that analysis that I was referring to, as more data has emerged, we've found that there's some big pillars, issues that sort of come up over and over. For example, communication is a critical component of medical error. So in medical schools, we have identified that as a significant point of focus. We spend a lot of time teaching medical students effective communication skills with patients. When patients bring in an additional third person, for example, an elderly patient brings in a daughter, and you have to speak really to two of them at a time, that's a different sort of communication environment. And then when we speak to each other, clinician to clinician, we spend a lot of time discussing and modeling and reflecting on and assessing how our students are learning that, how they work within the teamwork structure as well, has been a big part of the communication focus for us.
We talk about patients needing to be our own best advocates, and that's true anyway. I mean, it's probably a good idea to do that. Are there ways that we as patients can help you ensure that things are going well?
Well, certainly. The one thing that I see as a clinician a lot is the patients who come in a way, prepared to discuss their condition, who bring in some critical medical records that they may have from prior physician visits, a record summary, wherever they can, if they can bring in actual images of something, an x-ray that they had, a CAT scan that they had, the more of that information that the patient can provide, the less uncertainty that we have when we're collecting that information from the patient. So that's super important. That type of information is the patient's information, by the way. They can obtain that from prior caregivers by simply asking. So they could collect this of their own and bring it in for another clinician to see.
Oh, I'm sure that's even a bigger deal than ever before, because it seems like none of us just have one doctor anymore, but you almost have a team that treats you as people specialize. And in many cases, one doctor doesn't really know what the other was thinking or prescribing unless you keep these records, right, and present them to the physician you're working with.
Absolutely. And it has tremendous implications for the information being passed from clinician to clinician, but it also has cost implications. Unnecessary tests are not uncommonly repeated because one physician may not have the data, the image, et cetera, and it may take 5 weeks to get it, and you repeat it. So the patient undergoes an additional procedure. There's an additional cost. And it's potentially unnecessary. So it's very, very important for the patient to be sort of aware that as a central point of the story, they are the central point. And they could collect some of that and bring it with at a new visit, for example.
Dr. Sindhun, you guys are so busy as it is. Do you get annoyed when we come in with a big, you know, three-ring binder book with all of our records in it? Do you even have time to flip through them?
Well, you have to find the time, and the most complex patients require the most attention and bring the biggest records, but we do have to find the time to look through that. Annoyance is the wrong word. It is a challenge, and I think any physician would tell you that it's a challenge to have somebody with, you know, 300 data entries in a prior clinical setting that you're trying to rifle through. And again, a case where the patient can be very, very helpful can say, well, I actually had the procedure June 15th of 2014, and you can go to that record and see it, rather than I had it sometime last year. So any type of information like that is quite helpful to help us move the care forward.
Is the move to digital records, is that going to be a step towards a solution?
It's a step. I think the jury is a little bit out yet on whether it has yet been successful. There are challenges. Like any database, any engineering person will tell you that the database is as good as the data you put in it. And the electronic health record is a little bit like that. And sometimes electronic health records are pre-populated with some structures that automatically pull information, and all of a sudden, even a very, very basic visit to a doctor's office by a patient for a rash, for example, will generate a 4 or 5 page letter through which you have to sift to find that the patient's there for a rash, but in it is included every vital sign, all the lab work that may actually not be relevant. So there's a little bit of clutter that we have to figure out how to remove from the electronic health record while keeping the important, the critical nuggets of information that are really, really important.
You know, Dr. Juan Sendon, we're so grateful to the University of Central Florida College of Medicine for opening itself up to be able to talk to issues like this and address them, because they do affect us all, both on the medical side and the patient side. And this is the way solutions are found and discovered when we're all working together. Our thanks to Dr. Juan Sendon and the University of Central Florida College of Medicine. Find out what it really means to become a grandparent from a journalist's point of view. That's next on Growing Bolder.
We've got news. Watch.growingbolder.com, the world's first streaming site for active adults, is now live. Growing Bolder TV shows, national specials, documentaries, and inspiring videos on ordinary people living extraordinary lives 24/7 on demand for free. Watch.growingbolder.com is now live.
Mark and Bill here on Growing Bolder. Our next guest is one of the most well-respected journalists anywhere. Her credentials are unbelievable, from hosting Face the Nation to being White House correspondent during Presidents Carter, Reagan, and George H.W. Bush, and Mark for the last 25 years. 25 already. She's been a fixture as a reporter on 60 Minutes. She knows a story when she sees one.
She is a broadcasting icon, and that's why her latest book, folks, is so fascinating, because it's not about the environment or terrorism or world leaders. It's about grandparenting, and it's in a way that has not been looked at before. The book is called Becoming Grandma: The Joys and Science of the New Grandparenting. Let's say hello to Leslie Stahl. Hey, Leslie, how are you today?
I'm really good. How are you today?
Well, thank you for your time. We're doing great. And if anybody ever wondered about your feelings about being a grandmother, all they have to do is see the cover of your new book, where you're sitting there with those two little girls and you've got a smile from ear to ear. You kind of like the new role, don't you?
I don't like it, as my granddaughter would say. I love it. I love it. I have fallen, after thinking those days were over, I have fallen madly in love, and I don't say that lightly, with my granddaughters, just madly in love. And in interviewing grandparents, not only in this country, but other countries, we're all in this. We're all going through this, the same thing. We just fall deeply, emotionally, joyously, helplessly in love.
So that does happen, and not only does it happen, but there's got to be something else there, something that you've discovered that you want the rest of us to know about grandparenting.
Well, several things. One is that because it's universal, I was suspicious that it's, you know, that something deep within us, maybe something biochemical, is happening that is creating this similar behavior. And yes, our brains are actually rewired when we hold our grandchildren. We start secreting what they call a bonding hormone. It rewires our brain. And strangely and amusingly, one of the things that happens is our ability to say the word no is disabled. In the process, we all automatically turn into these indulgent kind of mush balls. You know, we may have been strict parents, but boy, we are such pushovers with these grandkids. And all grandparents joke about this amongst ourselves, you know? What happened to us?
We're talking with Leslie Stahl, folks, the broadcasting icon, and we're not talking about the news. We're talking about her joys in being a grandparent and her new book. And it really is kind of one of the great surprises in life. You know, I think we all say when we have kids, you really can't explain it until you have one. Harley Davidson writers say, if you have to ask, you'll never understand. Grandparenting is a little bit like that, isn't it? It's a great midlife surprise.
Oh, it's people say, you know, it's the best thing to be a grandparent, but you cannot understand the depth until it happens to you. And as I say, we are completely transformed, and fundamentally for most of us, for the vast majority, it's all good. It's all wonderful. It's wonderful as long as our children, the parents, let us in. You'd be surprised how many grandparents either never see their own grandchildren because they're not allowed to, or their visits are rationed. It hurt me to hear these stories. But for the vast majority of us, we are so transformed by these kids that there's this huge trend going on right now where people, when they retire, are picking up, leaving the house they've lived in for 50 years or whatever, and moving wherever the grandchildren are so that they can be in their lives.
And not only that, Leslie, but technology has really changed the game too, because you don't have to live in the same city or state. You don't even need to leave your own home. You can text and email, and you could Skype everywhere. Has this kind of expanded the ability of grandparents to be involved at a level that maybe they weren't before?
No question. I mean, if you live across the country as I do from my grandchildren, I am still in their lives in a way that is visual, not just over the phone, which, you know, little kids have trouble over the phone. They don't quite understand. But if you're sitting there looking at them and they're looking back, that connection is held. And then, in addition, if your kids are patient enough, they can turn their phones around and let you watch the kids play. I don't know. The whole technology thing has definitely, as you say, changed. It's a game changer.
You know, Leslie, we talk a lot on this program, Growing Bolder, about the transformational phenomenon of this age wave, 10,000 of us turning 65 a day now. 30,000 people are becoming grandparents every week, and for the most part...
Can you believe that, what you just said?
It is...
30,000 a week?
It is.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing, and they're for the most part, they're baby boomers, for better or for worse, and I'm guessing it's a little bit of both. How are baby boomers different when it comes to grandparenting?
Baby boomers have always wanted to stay young. And so we are relatively young grandparents. We are a little more involved, or maybe a lot more involved, taking the kids to the park, something I used to hate with my kid, but I don't mind with my grandchildren, and just being more fun. We're also, by the way, spending much more money on grandchildren than grandparents of old. Seven times more. We spend seven times more on grandchildren today than grandparents did just 10 years ago. And we're not just, when I say that, it's not just toys and clothes. I mean, we're doing the big ticket items. We're doing the crib, the car seat, medical bills, education, straightening their teeth. We're really in there in a deeper way, I think.
When it comes to Grandma Leslie, is it true what happens at Grandma's stays at Grandma's?
What happens to Grandma's? Well, not if you read my book, because what happened to me, I'm now telling everybody about. And I've now been on a book tour, and the grandparents that I'm meeting are telling me, yes, it's exactly the same with me, over and over and over again. So if people read the book, they're going to recognize themselves. And even, by the way, step-grandmothers. Step-grandmothers, if they're there, you know, when the baby's born, have exactly the same connection. It's identical. And surrogate grandparents can also become just as connected and get the same feeling of falling in love as biological grandparents. So and grandfathers. I know the title says grandmother, but I write a lot about grandfathers because they turn into marshmallows, and it's really amusing to our kids, particularly to see grandpa, you know, rolling around on the floor with the kids. And my husband has done tea parties and little tiny chairs and little tiny cups with the girls. It's just priceless.
Are you sure this is Leslie Stahl on the phone, the 60 Minutes reporter, you know, who faces down the toughest of the tough?
Right?
you know, how cool is it, Leslie? We all talk about the nuclear family is degenerating, it's disintegrating, but here you are. You come out with this interesting and informative book on how grandparenting maybe is more fulfilling than it's ever been. And man, can you imagine somebody having Leslie Stahl as a grandmother? But more and more grandparents are vibrant. They're working. They're setting. They're role models that are helping these kids see what's possible in their own lives at any age. She makes us think, makes us ask questions, and helps clear up some of the scientific and practical aspects of what she's found to be one of the greatest joys of her life. The book is called Becoming Grandma, and our guest has been Leslie Stahl. Get a pen and paper ready. When we come back, we'll tell you five things you can do to live a longer, happier life. This is Growing Bolder. Subscribe to Growing Bolder magazine, now with more information, articles, and photos than ever before. This quarterly publication is unlike any other, filled with the kind of inspiration you need to live your life to the fullest. More information at growingbolder.com/subscribe. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts. You are listening to Growing Bolder. I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton. Turn on any news program, surf the internet, or browse the aisles of any bookstore out there, and you're going to find tons of conflicting information. What to eat, what not to eat, what diets work and which ones don't, the hot new supplement you can't live without, and what fitness machine you have to buy.
It is very, very frustrating, but here's some good news, folks. Our next guest is a medical professor at Harvard. He has done extensive research, and he's come up with a few things that you can do today that he says are guaranteed to help you live a longer, healthier life. More good news? They will cost you next to nothing. And they're all in his new book. It's called The Big Five, Five Simple Things You Can Do to Live a Longer, Healthier Life. Let's hear from the author, Dr. Sanjeev Chopra. Hello, Doc. How are you?
Bill and Mark, delighted to be on your show.
And we are delighted to have you. And let's get this right out of the way, because you are one of the fabulous Chopra boys. You've got a brother by the name of Deepak, correct?
That is correct.
Man, your parents have raised some pretty impressive guys. So let's ask you, what made you want to step in and take on this topic?
You know, there's a lot of misinformation, not only amongst the lay public, but also amongst physicians, including primary care physicians. I have the greatest admiration for the primary care clinician. They're dealing with so much information. But if somebody read the book and said, you know, and go see their primary care tomorrow and say, I read that coffee is really good for you, he or she may say, everything in moderation. These studies come and go. They don't know all the evidence because they just don't have the time to read it up. So that's why I wrote the book.
All right, we're going to get right to it then, because you kind of jumped to number one already. We're talking to Harvard medical professor Dr. Sanjeev Chopra with The Big Five. The first of which a lot of people are going to like, drink coffee. You mentioned that coffee, moderation. What are you talking about there?
So I'm talking about drinking 2 to 4 cups of coffee a day, and it doesn't matter from which coffee or Java shop. The evidence is overwhelming that if you do that, it lowers the risk of cirrhosis, type 2 diabetes, Parkinsonism, dementia, and 5 cancers, common cancers, primary liver cancer, metastatic prostate cancer, colon cancer, skin cancer, and endometrial cancer. And so I'm a liver specialist, so I've been talking about coffee and its effect on the liver for 20 years. And then an article came in the New England Journal of Medicine, the premier journal, about 2.5-3 years ago, and it said coffee drinkers, men and women, have lower total and cause-specific mortality. And I got like 104 emails that day. Sanjeev, you're vindicated. So it also turns out the more you drink, the better the result. But I would say that, you know, max it out to around 3 or 4.
And of course, to qualify this, we've got these triple mocha, frappuccino, whatevers. We're talking about basic regular black coffee, right?
I'm just talking about a regular cup of coffee, whether you get it from Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks or you make it at home, you know, 2 to 4 cups, amazing benefits.
A lot of people out there trying to sell us vitamins and supplements, and I think for a lot of them, they're worthless. But you're a big fan of vitamin D. How come?
Yeah, so I think most of the vitamins and supplements is, sorry to say, a scam. Vitamin D3 is not a vitamin. It's actually a hormone. But there are multiple studies showing that people who have high normal levels of vitamin D, so they're still normal, but they're in the high range, they live longer. It's good for your bones, it's good for your muscles, good for your immune system, low risk of multiple sclerosis, MS. A recent study, people with MS who take high doses of vitamin D have less relapse. So the evidence is overwhelming. And, you know, we think we're getting vitamin D in sunny California or in Florida. Young kids playing soccer in Florida are turning out to be vitamin D deficient. The skin doctors have done a very good job, put sunblock, you know, to prevent skin cancer. And I think that's commendable. But what I suggest is get one vitamin D3 level checked in your blood once. And if you're deficient, then you need a lot, 50,000 international units a day, every week, not a day, every week till for 3 months. And then you need to take supplemental. And if you're sufficient, you should still take 2,000 to 4,000 international units a day.
I'm going to jump right to number 4 now, because the fourth one you had, the third one is to move, and we could talk about exercise,
right?
But we do that a lot. The fourth one caught my attention because you say if you're going to eat anything, eat nuts.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? So we've been told, we used to, as doctors, tell patients, be careful about eating nuts, a lot of calories, and you think you're eating 3 or 4, next thing you've had 40 nuts. Now there are multiple studies showing that nuts lower the risk of certain cancers. And then again, an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, even more recently, saying that individuals who eat nuts, and here's the amazing part, even if they don't exercise and are overweight, will live longer. And each pistachio has only 4 calories. So if you chew carefully and have 25 of those, and you have it before a major meal, you'll actually eat less. You won't gain weight. You might even lose weight. And you'll have consumed 100 calories, which is less than a slice of bread or a Coca-Cola.
Folks, we're talking with Dr. Sanjeev Chopra, who's written an amazing new book. It's called The Big Five, 5 Simple Things You Can Do to Live a Longer, Healthier Life. And, Doc, before we leave nuts, are we talking about raw nuts? Is that important, or can we have roasted and salted nuts?
We can have roasted and salted nuts, and including the lowly peanut. You know, it's referred to as the lowly peanut. So people did research and looked at the peanut, and that has the same effect. So peanuts, pistachios, pine nuts, almonds, walnuts, not coconut and not macadamia. They're very rich in saturated fat. So, you know, I have an easy way for people to remember all 5. I say on a good sunny day, don't put sunblock. Go to your favorite Java shop. Have a brisk walk. Now you got the vitamin D, the exercise, and the coffee. Don't go nuts remembering this. And before you go, which is the 5th chapter, meditate. And there's a wonderful ancient saying, you should meditate once a day, and if you don't have time to do that, you should meditate twice a day.
Now, this isn't some chef who or a nutrition guy or some guy trying to market some stuff at you. This is a guy with credentials, folks, that is advocating these simple steps. And I think, Doc, don't you find that we overcomplicate things? And you know, we're so swayed by the next great marketing campaign that we overlook everything you're telling us.
Yeah, and that's why I decided to write the book. And you know, people who read the book will see scores and scores of articles referenced in peer-reviewed journals. Somebody will tell me, I heard this does that. And I say, wonderful, where did you read it? And they'll send me, and it's a blog or it's somebody's opinion. It's not in a scientific journal. We've even seen stuff on famous TV shows, which has not been, you know, validated in any scientific literature. I also am very open. I have a saying, the mind is like a parachute. It only works when it's open. And that the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So I have a lot of friends who drink tea, and they say, what about tea? And I said, listen, all the research is on coffee. There's not any research on tea. If you simply cannot drink coffee, then drink tea. It's rich in antioxidants. The research is not there to back it up, but it might come down the road, and I'm not telling you not to drink tea.
I love this guy.
Yeah, he is fabulous, folks. The book is called The Big Five, Five Simple Things You Can Do to Live a Longer, Healthier Life. Pick it up and see how it might change your life. Our thanks to the incredible Dr. Sanjeev Chopra. Hey, Doc, thanks so much.
Have the takeaway for you before we go. Don't be a dweller. When things go wrong, don't hang on. Don't let yourself dwell on who's to blame. You don't have to call anybody out or even get even. Experts say dwelling can be paralyzing. It's just not worth it. So don't be a dweller. You'll be happier, healthier, and more successful if you choose to just move on. And that's what we call growing bolder.